strength versus strength. You have one of the best offenses with Oregon against an elite defense with Texas Tech. And I'll dig in a little bit here on this preview. I'll show you what I went to. I wanted to, you know, look at their four hardest opponents that they played. Oregon, of course, they're off the charts on offense statistically. How'd they perform against their four strongest defenses? And that, of course, for them was Indiana, Iowa, Washington, Wisconsin. In those four tough defense spots, they were held significantly under their averages, averaging 20 points a game, 300 yards a game, 4.4 yards per play, well below the season average.
This is VSiN's College Football Betting Podcast.
Welcome in another edition of the VSiN College Football Betting Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Murray, joined, as always, on Mondays by Adam Burke. A little bit later on, Brett Ciancia of Pick 6 Previews. He will jump on the podcast and we will break down the four quarterfinal games. Always enjoy hearing Brett's breakdowns of those games. But Adam Burke, Christmas has come and gone. The greatest Christmas movie delivered yet again. The Hawaii Bowl on Christmas Eve, down 21 to nothing. I will say there was some doubt by the Hawaii homer here that the Rainbow Warriors would get there, but never, never in doubt in a very fun, entertaining Hawaii Bowl. The only game on the board, the chase game came through, Adam Burke, and our Rainbow Warriors, our beloved Bows, 21-6-1 ATS on their home turf under Timmy. One more victory for our guy on what was a banner year for the Hawaii Rainbow Warriors.
Yeah, probably got a little bit of a boost from the announcement that Mike Alahato would be back too. That's always something that helps as you're heading into a bowl game, especially with what we have going on in the transfer portal now. But I got to ask, I haven't been paying close enough attention, but is Matt Eumanns on like a Stormy at BYU run when it comes to being in attendance at Hawaii games?
So he went to the opener. We were there, of course, doing the show there. So we got the victory there with Hawaii over Stanford. He went back, was in the rain for the San Diego State game, dominant performance by the Bows, and then was there for the bowl game. I think that's it. I think so. He attended three. He went 3-0, by the way, ATS this year. So maybe the good luck charm is Mr. Eumanns being out there at the Ching Complex. You know, all kidding aside, the atmosphere for that game, it's not a enormous stadium. Obviously, it's kind of a makeshift stadium there on the campus of Hawaii. But for a bowl season that, let's be real, I've covered two bowl games already this year. I got one more coming up on New Year's Eve. Not usually the most well-attended things outside of the playoff games. And that game was packed, man. It was a great atmosphere, really fun game. Came down to the wire. You got a backup quarterback coming in, throwing a touchdown. So, had everything that you could ask for in a bowl game. And we will get to the shenanigans also in the New Mexico Bowl, because maybe, Adam, I have atoned for my sins from the James Madison bad beat, and I will be quiet because I had no business getting the cover in the San Diego State North Texas game.
Yeah, I wound up taking San Diego State too, so I am really fortunate with that one. But I will tell you, I'll tease something here for you that we are planning some special programming for that week before the Super Bowl in terms of looking back primarily at the football season. Some of the most memorable betting moments of the year. And you think about Emery DeMercado's fumble and the Cardinals-Titans game, Survivor Carnage on Thanksgiving, stuff like that. We got a very late entry here for the football season with that North Texas and San Diego State game, to be sure.
You know, Stanford Steve and Van Pelt on their podcast always say they signed up for 60. Well, scoring a touchdown with 1 second to go, leaping over the goal line to get into the end zone, no chance to win the game. They definitely, San Diego State, signed up for 60. And you know what? I'll say this. In a year of everyone opting out and a big reason why I bet San Diego State was trying to get ahead of the news that most of that North Texas team I fully anticipated to opt out. They did not. Now, the defense might have just opted out because they were not very good, but Drew Mestemaker played in that game. All the other pieces for North Texas played in that game. They got the win, but San Diego State, what a crazy-ass cover that was in the end of the New Mexico Bowl.
Do you remember the last game where you saw both teams run for over 7 yards a carry?
something from the Big 12 like 10 years ago?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I mean, North Texas had two dudes, 198 and 152. Bert Emanuel Jr. filling in as kind of the quarterback running back for San Diego State. 11 carries for 170 yards. 7.1 for San Diego State, 7.7 for North Texas. This maybe going forward here with Sean Lewis, this is not the same San Diego State team that's going to have to win games like 17 to 14 or something like that.
Yeah, it was definitely surprising to see the struggles that San Diego State had defensively, but offensively, yeah, maybe this is maybe we get back to the Kent State flash fast types of teams that they had up there in the MAC. Those were some.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'll just say those were just some fun games. I was actually I did a bowl game with our buddy Mike Sanford, who people might remember because we're a degenerate gambling podcast. But there was a Frisco Bowl back in 2019. It was Jordan Love versus Kent State, Utah State versus Kent State. And that was like one of the more entertaining pre-Christmas bowl games I could remember. And that was Sean Lewis calling the plays there for Kent State then.
There's one other bowl game that I want to talk about there before we get into Kyle Whittingham to Michigan and all the upcoming games. Dude, what the hell has happened to Clemson? Like, you got Cade Klubnik, who's been playing in that program forever. Just a nothing burger out of him. They can't run the football whatsoever. You figure Penn State's had so much going on that, like, they're probably not going to be that interested, that invested. And, you know, for the most part, I mean, offensively, they weren't very interested in that game until the fourth quarter. But, dude, what is happening with Dabo down there in Clemson?
You know, it's funny because you watch the pregame coverage of that. You see them wiping the snow away at Yankee Stadium. The temperatures were like in the teens. And you're thinking, oh, my God, these teams are going to want nothing to do with this bowl game. I played first half and full game under. It was 6-3 at halftime. So it was a nice winner. I jumped on the tailgate show with Ben Stevens. He was filling in for me because I was on the road. And I said, I don't see how there's points in this game at all. You started to see a little bit in the fourth quarter. But it's a fair question to ask. And, you know, Penn State, this will be more of an off-season podcast discussion with Matt Campbell, but you're seeing all the opt-outs or the transfer portal pieces headed for Iowa State. You would imagine a lot of them head to Happy Valley. I think Penn State ultimately got a pretty good hire in Matt Campbell. Personally, I think it was better than Kalani Sitake. I just didn't really understand that fit, and it didn't ultimately come to fruition. I think Penn State's in a decent situation moving forward. You look at their schedule next year, it's very, very manageable. I believe off the top of my head, they avoid Oregon, Ohio State. I think they avoid Indiana. So they have a very doable schedule next year, the Nittany Lions do. But you're on to something here with Clemson, man, because this was a team that, you know, coming into this year, I bet them to win the ACC. There were people that bet them to win the national title. It was, you know, looking at the ACC, Adam, how does this team not make the playoff? And to have that stinker, especially as you pointed out, Cade Klubnik played, right? A longtime starter. A lot of their pieces offensively played. Now, some of the defense opted out, understandably so. But yeah, that was pretty eye-opening there for Clemson. And you do wonder long-term, what is the Clemson situation moving forward right now?
Well, and look, I mean, you know, after all of his resistance to the transfer portal, like, Dabo kind of had some semblance of an awakening. It's not like they use it the way that other programs do, but at least he started to pick up a few guys here and there. You know, his old NIL comment about, you know, the program being in God's name, image and likeness and all of that. Like, players want to get paid, bro. They want money, you know, and if Clemson's not going to pony up for anybody outside of the program, then is this the new Clemson, a team that goes 7-6 in a very pedestrian ACC where, yeah, they beat South Carolina, but I mean, South Carolina was a dumpster fire by the end of the year. I don't know, man. It's going to be really interesting to see how we evaluate this team going into next season. And like you said, that's an off-season topic, but the power dynamics in college football and the way they're kind of shuffling and shifting around and all of that, getting to be really, really interesting. And if a program like Clemson isn't going to be open-minded about using the portal and is going to just try and do this thing from within, this may be not the exception and just the norm for them going forward.
All right, a couple other notes I wanted to pass across just from the early bowl games. FIU, I give them credit. Willie Simmons, they went for 10 fourth downs. That's what it's about, baby. They got their ass kicked, but they just said, screw it. It's a bowl game. We're going to go for fourth downs nonstop. UTSA was down 14-0 and went on a 57-6 run to close out that game. So live betting sometimes is beneficial if you pick the right spots. New Mexico-Minnesota was actually a really fun game to watch. And Minnesota, it's important to get the right numbers, right? New Mexico was 3.5 early on in bowl season. You saw steam come in on the Lobos, closed around 1.5. Game lands 3 in overtime with a diving catch in the end zone. PJ Fleck, I think he's 7-0 in bowl games now, straight up. But New Mexico, Jason Eck looks like he's going to be hanging out. I would imagine, Adam, New Mexico's going to be a team in that, you know, new look Mountain West with Boise State gone and San Diego State gone. New Mexico, I would envision, is going to be the betting favorite heading into the next year for the Mountain West. And also, how about Anthony Calandria of UNLV? Not only did he play horrifically in the bowl game against Ohio, the Frisco Bowl, he on December 15th said, I'm not going anywhere. And then shortly thereafter, hits the transfer portal. So Anthony Calandria looks like he will be finding a new home next year, the Mountain West Player of the Year, Offensive Player of the Year. And then the Nard Dog. Gotta love it. Nard Dope. Pittsburgh closes as almost a 2-touchdown favorite against East Carolina. ECU has a true freshman quarterback, bunch of opt-outs, and leave it to the Nard Dog to lose outright as a 2-touchdown favorite against East Carolina in the Military Bowl. Just warm my heart to see that unfold there for Pitt.
Yeah, it's the old Seinfeld gif where he says, that's a shame. And he's just sitting there eating popcorn. Dude, Blake Harrell's a hell of a coach, man. Like,
they were ready to go, man.
Yeah, they were ready to go, especially with all those opt-outs. And also, I mean, you know, lost his coordinators too. Yeah. You know, but they were just ready to go. And Blake Harrell, I mean, next year's probably his last year at East Carolina in one way, shape, or form. Whether he goes and beats a DC at a premier program or gets a head coaching job. And that is the tough thing, right, about this ecosystem of college football. You get some of these teams that, you know, have these big showings. I mean, hell, John Hauser got himself the job at Ohio, I think.
Yeah.
They were probably leaning that way anyway, but holding UNLV to 10 points, shutting them out in the first half, just a phenomenal effort out of the Bobcats there when I honestly thought they would come into this game a little bit shell-shocked with everything that's happened within the program. UNLV would kind of take it to them. Not the case at all. Probably one of the worst bowl bets I've ever made with UNLV -6.5 there. But, you know, it's just it's interesting, man, the way some of these coaches kind of make a name for themselves, get themselves jobs, and then, you know, again, a topic for the offseason, but, you know, I know Brad Powers has talked about this a ton before, the bowl bounce, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Ohio with this big defensive performance, John Hauser gets the job, like, Ohio's probably going to be a little bit overrated going into next season in a horrific Mid-American conference, so, you know, all these things to kind of keep an eye on and think about, but you know, it is interesting to kind of look at this and with all the opt-outs and the portal and, you know, guys getting opportunities and all of that, you know, motivation still seemingly plays a role in these bowl games as we kind of saw with some of the recent results.
Yeah, I mean, look, I was at 2 bowl games so far on the sidelines, and Washington State, I'll just say this, for a team that their coach left to go to Iowa State, there were a bunch of fifth-year seniors. They were pumped up to be in that bowl game, and I was really impressed by what I saw from them. And then I was at Fresno State. Fresno State, I'll say this, Matt Entz has that program going in the right direction. They're going to be a team very physical in that game. Not the most aesthetically pleasing game. It was nice to see Snoop Dogg in his element. Man, I'll say this real quickly. I was down on the sidelines for the bowl season radio coverage of the Snoop Dogg Arizona Bowl. 18-3 final. Fresno State got the win. They were dominant in that game. Should have won by more. I haven't looked at the post-game win expectancy. I'm sure it was 100%. They completely dominated that game. A couple of turnovers, etc. But Snoop Dogg, man, that guy, he's just a showman. I mean, you saw it on Christmas Day That was a phenomenal halftime performance by him. Lainey Wilson shows up. Andre Bocelli shows up. I mean, it's like everyone was a part of that halftime show. And then he showed up at the bowl game. He walked over. So right before the start of the second half, Adam, I am in front of Fresno State's locker room. And I'm waiting for Matt Entz to come out because I do the opposite of what TV does. So I got the losing coach walking into the locker room, with which was Chuck Martin of Miami. And then I got Matt Entz coming back onto the field and Snoop Dogg's walking over. And I'm like, I think he's kind of beelining towards me because I have my microphone. I got my headset on and I'm like quickly going in my microphone. I'm like, hey, are you guys rolling? And the producer up in the booth was like, yeah, we're rolling. And Snoop Dogg comes over. He's like, what's up, man? What's up, homie? And I'm like, and I'm trying to like think, I'm like, does he want to interview right now? And he just was kind of messing around with me. And then I asked him because the company I do these games for is Bowl Season Radio, thinking quickly as a radio guy, I said, hey, can you say you're listening to Bowl Season Radio? He's like, you're listening to Bowl Season Radio. And it just walks away. It was awesome. He caught I don't know if people have seen it. He was doing an in-game interview with the CW. And on a kickoff, he just jumped out of the interview and caught the kickoff in the end zone. He was like rolling around. I mean, that's what bowl season's about. You have the Pop-Tarts Bowl going full on nutso down there in Orlando, and Snoop Dogg being a part of this bowl game just gives it a little bit something extra. And I'll say this last thing about this bowl game, Adam. So after every game, I'm on the field and I'm trying to just get post-game interviews, and usually it's pretty easy, right? They're just kind of puttering around and I can get anybody. After the Snoop Dogg Bowl, every single player was out of there to go wait for the lowrider entrance of Snoop Dogg bringing in the trophy. It was incredible. I mean, those dudes were so fired up to get a picture, to get their trophy is like a little piece of bling that they all wear. It's really well done. I hope that he sticks around and does this bowl game for a while, because like you said, I mean, look, it wasn't a great game, but I'm sure those Fresno State players are going to remember it for a while. It was pretty cool to see how it all played out, and he embraces being the name of that bowl game for sure.
I mean, the dude's just timeless, right? I mean,
he really is.
You know, also, I just looked this up while you were talking. I cannot believe he's only 54 years old, which kind of really puts into perspective like how young he was when his career really took off and started going, and. You know, I mean, he's had his hands in lots and lots of different things, but that's awesome to hear, especially for these kids that, you know, are a couple generations really below you and I, to still be embracing Snoop Dogg like that. It's pretty fantastic.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Bowl Season Radio, Coca-Cola Bowl Season Radio, still got a couple more broadcasts left. On New Year's Eve, they will have the broadcast of the Sun Bowl. That'll be at 2 p.m. Eastern. Arizona State taking on Duke. You can catch that game on satellite radio XM 201. I'll be on the sidelines of the Vegas Bowl, Nebraska and Utah. That'll be on XM 202. On January 2nd, the Armed Forces Bowl, Rice and Texas State, XM 201. And then they will have the call of the East-West Shrine Bowl, which will be taking place down at the Star facility on January 27th. You can catch that on Sirius XM channel 88 for all of bowl listings at Bowl Season Radio. And you can listen to every game for free on the Varsity app, which I was doing because my flight was delayed 3 hours back from Phoenix to Vegas. So I was meandering around the Phoenix airport, Adam, listening to Bowl Season Radio on the Varsity app, because I had nothing else to do except walk around the Phoenix airport on a couple days ago. But let's
You could have driven back in 4.5 hours.
I really could have. I was wildly confused because our play-by-play guy, Scotty Gerard of Utah State, our engineer dropped him off at the airport. And I was like, this isn't our airport. It was the Mesa airport. I was not aware of the Mesa airport. He was flying out of there, and then we got dropped off at the Phoenix airport.
Well, is he flying private? Like, you got to get on that level, man.
No, he was not flying private. I don't know. He's getting his way back.
One of those little puddle jumpers?
Maybe. Before we get to the quarterfinals, Adam, as we look ahead to some of the games on the 30th and 31st, look, USC TCU's a mess. It felt like TCU would be a good bet, and then Josh Hoover opted out. So as we look at the 30th, we've got a couple of games. Tennessee, Illinois in the Music City Bowl right now. Tennessee about a 2.5-point favorite, really high total in that one. So you should get some fireworks, at least based off of the number. And then USC, TCU, Maiava's going to play, but he's not going to have his main wide receivers. Makai Lemon is not going to play. Jacoby Lane's not going to play. A lot of defensive players out in that game. Anything on the 30th for you?
Not really, to be honest with you. I mean, it's so tough now with all these guys opting out and just wondering, you know, if these teams really want to be there. I do think that the Independence Bowl is interesting between Coastal Carolina and Louisiana Tech, because Coastal's interim head coach here is Jeremiah Johnson, who was the defensive coordinator at La Tech last year. But he's also going to be on Colin Klein's staff at Kansas State, be the defensive backs coach. So he's halfway out the door already for Coastal Carolina anyway. So just an interesting thing that, you know, he was the DC of the team that he's facing, but you know, we've seen the total kind of tick up a little bit, and we've seen La Tech take some money there. So I don't think the bettors are really concerned about that angle at all.
The game that, I'll be honest, you know, outside of the game I'll be doing on New Year's Eve, Utah and Nebraska, we could talk about that here in a moment. But the game that intrigues me the most on New Year's Eve, outside of the obvious Ohio State-Miami quarterfinal, I think this game between Iowa and Vanderbilt in the ReliaQuest Bowl down in Tampa is going to be really fun to watch. Now, I'll say this. I've been to a once-upon-a-time Outback Bowl that Iowa was a part of. Those fans will take over that stadium. There are going to be a ton of Hawkeye fans down in Tampa to escape Iowa, to go down to Florida. They're going to be all over that stadium. And look, Iowa, we know what they are. They're not very sexy offensively with Mark Gronowski, but they're going to get after you defensively. And Vanderbilt under Diego Pavia and Clark Lee have been darlings against the spread. I think they're third or fourth best team in the country against the spread this year. There's a 4.5 still out there at FanDuel. I'm going to take the points with Iowa here. I think this is a war, and I think Iowa would love nothing more than to kind of shut up Diego Pavia. Has anybody turned more heel in college football in recent years than Diego Pavia? He was the kind of the lovable underdog, and now I feel like everyone's like, I'm kind of tired of this dude. You can go.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of feels like Johnny Manziel sort of, but everyone kind of thought that Johnny Manziel was immature to begin with. So, you know, he was kind of a guy who never shied away from it, whereas Pavia, it seems like it's kind of blooming late in his collegiate career here. So
now he did pee on New Mexico's facility.
That's true.
I guess that was true. A little more under the radar because he was at New Mexico State.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe Manziel would be the closest comp that I could think of. But look, I mean, there are some guys that have reason to not play for Iowa here, but it doesn't seem like there's any opt-outs of great significance. I mean, Kirk Ferentz, you know, kind of coming out and saying, look, we're probably going to have our roster pretty much intact. And what do we know about Iowa? They're always good in the secondary. They always find a way to force turnovers. You know, Pavia is going to be out there trying to be the star of the show in this one. Maybe tries to force some things. I like Iowa in this game too. And I think, you know, for Iowa, I mean, it is Vanderbilt, right? But it's a top 15 Vanderbilt team. Like the chance to knock off a pretty highly ranked SEC team. I got something that's very attractive to Iowa and to Kirk Ferentz. And like you said, I mean, the chance to go from Iowa to Tampa in late December. I mean, I got a buddy of mine who lives in Iowa, and you know, him and his wife just bought a place in South Carolina, you know, so they could escape the winter. So you give anybody from the Midwest, Great Plains, Great Lakes area, the chance to get out of Dodge in late December, they're going to take it. So I think Iowa will have a pretty significant crowd advantage there in that one at Raymond James. So yeah, I like them. Plus the 4, I mean, again, you know, the other thing about Vanderbilt is, like, how are they going to stack up in the trenches in this game, right? We know that Iowa's always good in the trenches, those corn-fed dudes that come out of the Midwest. Like, Vanderbilt's kind of flashy, kind of skill position dominant. I don't know, man. I think Iowa's in a pretty good spot here with this matchup.
You know, and not in every game, but a lot of these games that you feel like are going to be grinders tend to be grinders. So I'm going to be on first half under to 23.5. I think will be a play for me. Look, you saw Iowa, and granted, it was in that slop fest against Oregon, but they want to grind it out. They did it against Indiana. So I think this is going to be a ugly first half. It's good on good and bad on bad when you look at some of the numbers. Good defense for Iowa. Good offense for Vandy, bad defense for Vandy, bad offense for Iowa. I'm looking forward to that game, noon on New Year's Eve. Let's get to my bowl game, Nebraska-Utah. And boy, this is pretty fascinating. So Kyle Whittingham, we thought this was going to be the swan song. And then we found out, hey, he's leaving, but he still wants to coach. And now he's the head coach of Michigan. So he is not going to be there for this bowl game. It is officially the Morgan Scali era underway. Morgan Scali, a lifer at Utah, played under Urban Meyer in the early 2000s, has been on the staff for almost two decades, has been the coach in waiting for like 5 or 6 years. So Morgan Scali officially gets the job. I don't anticipate any Utah players to be opting out of this game based off of the news that Whittingham won't be there, but it just adds a kind of weird element to this game. But before we get to Kyle Whittingham, what do you make of this spot? Because Nebraska, look, we know Dylan Raiola is in the portal, but he wasn't going to play anywhere. Matt Rhule said earlier this week that TJ Lateef is a full go. He got hurt against Iowa, but he is 100% healthy, so he should be good to go. Utah's the better team, but could you make a case for Nebraska to keep this thing competitive?
Yeah, I think you really could. I mean, this is a pretty big number here. When you talk about two touchdowns in this game, where this is one where, you know, you're not playing for an interim, right? I mean, this is a guy who was kind of put on third base immediately in Morgan Scali when, you know, he was added to the program, right? I mean, he was going to be the coach in waiting. So this is just kind of what the players expected, probably. So it's like you're going to get any sort of bump, I don't think, necessarily, out of them, especially because Whittingham is typically good in the bowl season, very good at maximizing his roster, maximizing his talent. We don't really know that, you know, with the former DC turned head coach. So I think that's a fair question. And I think Matt Rhule's a dude who's going to have his team ready to go. I mean, yeah, they're not as talented and they are, you know, missing some guys here, but Lateef, not in the portal. Seems like he's going to be the guy for next year. So there's a lot of incentive to, you know, really focus on his reps and focus on what he's able to do in this football game. And so I think this number is just too big. I mean, I'm hoping for your sake that you do get an exciting football game because you didn't have the most exciting of games there, you know, with Miami and Fresno. So I'm hoping for your sake you get one.
I got to talk to Snoop Dogg.
That's true. I mean, I don't know what kind of celebrities will be there in Vegas for this game, but hopefully you run into a couple here or there.
I would say this. I've done the Vegas Bowl. This will be my fourth. I did Wisconsin versus Arizona State, Jaden Daniels' last game and Herm Edwards' last game with Arizona State. That was in 21. Then I did Oregon State, Florida. Oregon State destroyed Sunbelt Billy in Florida. And then I did Northwestern and Utah, which was an upset. And that was when David Braun was given the full-time gig. Did not do the game last year, so this will be my fourth installment. I think this is going to be the best crowd because Nebraska fans coming out to Vegas, they were at the Pinstripe Bowl last year. I think Nebraska fans are going to relish the opportunity to come out to Vegas for New Year's Eve. So looking forward to that from an atmosphere standpoint. And once again, that game 3:30 Eastern, and catch me on the sidelines on Bowl Season Radio. All right, before we get to the playoff games, Adam, let's do a quick little promo for you on what's coming up over at VSiN.com.
There's a lot, man. It's busy all the time. You know, over at VSiN.com, we're still running our holiday special. $79 gets you an all-access pass from now through May 1st over there at the website. And that includes our Opta AI player prop projections for the NFL as well as the NBA. Still pumping out these bowl previews, 72 hours lead time minimum on these games, which kind of a blessing and a curse, I guess, with the way that the transfer portal is kind of shaking out. But college basketball is really ramping back up now, too. And you know, I'm doing a daily article Monday through Saturday. We get Greg Peterson's picks every single day. Tyler Shoemaker's projections for men's and women's college basketball. It's really getting to be college basketball season now. We're through the exams. We're through the holidays. We're into conference play for the most part here, starting the first week of January. So if you haven't been paying a lot of attention to college basketball, and most people probably haven't been, Greg Peterson, myself, Tyler Shoemaker, we've been paying attention all season long. So that's a really good asset and resource for you over at VSiN.com. And of course, you know, Zach Cohen on the NBA, Jonathan Davis on the NHL. We got you covered, man. I know people think that when football slows down, the sports betting world slows down. That's not the way it works.
Well, and shout out to our friends over at Rainbow Authentics. As we talked about to open up the podcast, what a finish to the season for the Bows. Shout out to our guy, Timmy Chang, for coming on the podcast. And the Tokyo Toe, I don't know if you guys saw this. He had a send-off signing on December 27th where there were people waiting in line for hours to get autographs from Kansei Matsuzawa, hit a couple of field goals in the Hawaii Bowl. And if you want some gear, well, there's still time to get some Lou Groza finalist Kansei Matsuzawa gear. He's taking his precision and power to your closet with Tokyo Toe apparel, bold design, premium comfort, and 100% fan energy. Whether you're tailgating or tuned in, represent greatness. TokyoToe.com, TokyoToe.com. And curious to see where the self-taught kicker, Adam Burke, will land on Sundays, because he is headed to the mainland to train for the NFL. But one final send-off there and a couple of made field goals in that victory on New Year's Eve. All right, before we, I guess we got plenty of time. I was going to say, before we wrap up, let's dive into the main event, Miami, Ohio State, the first of four quarterfinals. What do you got?
Should we talk about Kyle Whittingham, since we just talked about Utah?
Oh, yeah. I'll say this. With the situation regarding Sherrone Moore, I think getting Kyle Whittingham in there is a big win from a culture, from a no-nonsense type of mindset. They're going to get Jay Hill, the defensive coordinator from BYU. That's already been well reported, so he is headed to Michigan. We will see if the offensive coordinator, Beck, who went from New Mexico to Utah, if he follows to Michigan. That's kind of up in the air right now. It was overwhelmingly applauded on social media. What a hire. This is so great. I think it's the best they could do at this point, Adam, knowing the situation, to get a guy like Kyle Whittingham. But, like, I don't know, man. He's been in Utah for 20-plus years. How is this going to translate over to the Big Ten? I'm just a bit skeptical. When I see everybody kind of overwhelmingly, you know, giving this an A+, I'm just a little skeptical of how this ultimately plays out. I'm not ready to crown Michigan champions in 2026 or 2027 just yet.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head here. I think you applaud this hire in the context that it was made. They need an adult in the room really, really badly. I think that's extremely evident at this point in time, especially if Wink Martindale couldn't really have, you know, a significant amount of impact on what was happening within that program. Because that's a guy that's been around forever. And I'm sure he dealt with some stuff in the NFL that, you know, would pale in comparison to what's been happening at the college ranks. But even he couldn't really seem to make any inroads with what was going on with Sherrone Moore and everything around the program. So there's that. And look, I think Whittingham, to your point, right, of all the guys that Michigan was allegedly linked to, where now guys are coming out saying, yeah, we never talked, like the Jeff Broms of the world, which wouldn't have been a very good hire either. You know, look, I mean, I think getting Whittingham, as you said, is the best they could do at this point in time. And like I said, having an adult in the room will help. That being said, right, Utah, to me, I think of as like a program that recruits regionally, right? I mean, there's certainly the religious elements at schools like BYU, at Utah, Utah State, stuff like that, that kind of keep a pipeline going to the school. You know, there are some, and they get a lot of the same types of players in the offensive line, right? You get some of the Samoans, or you get the Hawaiians, or, you know, stuff like that. Michigan is a program that, to have success, needs to recruit nationally. I don't know how many tools Kyle Whittingham has for that in his toolkit. And Whittingham is a guy who's been great against the spread, great at playing against the USCs of the world or the UCLAs of the world, the teams that, you know, were getting the better talent, getting the higher star recruits, stuff like that. Now those are the guys he's supposed to get being at Michigan. I don't know how that's going to work out. They're always good in the trenches, right? Whittingham's talking about he wants to run the football. Cool. That's what you did in the Big Ten 10 to 15 years ago. It's not really what you do in the Big Ten now. I don't know, man. I think, like, the position they were in, it's a good hire, but I don't know that Whittingham really brings success, national success, to this program. And also, how long is he going to be there? Is a pretty fair question, too. But, like, I don't know, man. It's just, it's very different trying to recruit to Ann Arbor than it is recruiting to Salt Lake City.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, I think it's going to be one of those things, Adam, where out of the chute, if they could be physical and back to what they wanted, you know, ultimately were at the end of the Harbaugh era, we'll see. You know, Bryce Underwood apparently is going to stick around. So does he improve? Does he bring in Beck to be his offensive coordinator? Curious to see how the staff ultimately comes together. And also, you know, it's worth noting, too, the trickle down. How many coaches are going to leave Utah? How many coaches are going to leave BYU? Is there that trickle down effect? Because that area, that Utah BYU, there's just so much crossover with coaching staffs and ties. And Kyle Whittingham doesn't have this big, you know, coaching tree necessarily, right? So who are the pieces that he brings ultimately to Ann Arbor? Fine hire, but I'm not ready to say it was, you know, the best hire of this cycle. If they were able to get Kalen DeBoer, if Alabama had lost to Oklahoma, I would have said that was an A+. I think we've hit it. Like, for the timing, that's good, but I'm not overwhelmed by a 66-year-old who was kind of being pushed out at Utah.
Well, and look, I'm not going to pretend that Virginia and Michigan is an apples-to-apples comparison, right? I mean, the resources at Michigan are just dramatically higher, right? The status of the program is just, you know, significantly higher and all of that. But Rocco Mendenhall almost won 100 games at BYU, 99-43. And he was 36-38 at Virginia, right? Like, he did get them to 9-5. They won the Coastal one time. They played in the Orange Bowl and lost. Like, he had the one year where things kind of stood out a little bit. But, you know, again, leaving just sort of that built-in pipeline with a program like BYU, you know, I mean, he, again, a guy, to your point, right, didn't really have a lot of branches on that coaching tree. Didn't really have a lot of rapport with, you know, high school coaches across Texas or Florida or, you know, anywhere on the East Coast, really, taking the job at Virginia. Like, Mendenhall's not really, Whittingham's not really plugged in to recruiting the Great Lakes region, where you've got a lot of really good football players in Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania and all of that. Like, I don't know, man. I don't think that Whittingham's a guy that can win you a national championship at Michigan, maybe even get you into the playoff at Michigan, I think could be a stretch. It's just a different beast, man. And again, maybe Mendenhall's not the right cautionary tale to use because Virginia and Michigan are just so dramatically different, but he had problems getting talent, you know, out there to Charlottesville. So I could see the same thing for Whittingham here in Ann Arbor.
Yeah. It'll be a fun off-season discussion too, how things come together portal wise and how they utilize those resources, certainly moving forward. Well, there are ties to Urban Meyer because Urban Meyer, obviously, and Kyle Whittingham worked together, and Urban Meyer, Ohio State. So let's jump into it right now when it comes to this particular spot here. Ohio State, a 9.5-point favorite against Miami. Tens did show up for a brief moment on Sunday. I did take a little bit of 10 just from a numbers standpoint, Adam. You know this Ohio State program very well. Obviously, they've been off since the Big Ten championship loss. And when you think back, last year, Ohio State loses to Michigan. Then they go scorched earth. Ohio State loses to Indiana. Do they go scorched earth here? What do you make of the quarterfinal on New Year's Eve?
Well, it's a possibility that they go scorched earth, right? I mean, you know, Ryan Day taking over the play calling for Brian Hartline. Obviously, he felt like Hartline just wasn't close enough to the program right now with everything going on with South Florida and all of that to be the one calling plays. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I do know that one of the knocks I have on Ryan Day over the years is that I think he gets very conservative. I think he will put too much of the burden on the defense. Maybe it was because it was Julian Sain's first game, but we kind of saw that in the game against Texas. He's done it in the past with other quarterbacks. And, you know, I mean, look, they gave that game away against Indiana, the Big Ten championship game. They had two long drives in the second half, didn't convert the fourth down, stupidly kicked the field goal. Like, that's a game that they probably should have won. Credit to Indiana for making the plays when they needed to. But Ohio State was a better team in the second half of that game, and they still weren't able to win it. So with Day's fingerprints all over that type of situation, I'm a little bit concerned. Also, that Miami-Texas A&M game, there were car crashes all over the field. That was an insanely physical football game.
Yeah, it was.
But when I saw Miami's injury report, you know, Torre seems like he's going to be good to go after that concussion that he suffered at the goal line. It looks like Poyser's going to play too, I think, who left the game with a shoulder. Like, I thought maybe that would be something that would be a positive for Ohio State. Miami could be missing a couple of guys on defense, but it seems like they're going to be good to go. I make the number 8, so there's a little bit of line value to me in Miami at 9.5. I don't see this game going over the total.
Yeah.
I mean, I say that and watch it become a shootout, but like, Shannon Dawson would have nothing to do with Carson Beck throwing the football against Texas A&M. Nothing whatsoever. They won that game because Mark Fletcher had a couple of big explosive runs. Probably doesn't get those against Ohio State. So unless Carson Beck's going to do something, I think Miami's going to struggle to score. And I thought Corey Heatherman, the DC for Miami, did a hell of a job against Texas A&M. Kept Marcel Reed bottled up, didn't let him get out and run, forced the interceptions. Sands had a couple of bad reads here late in the season with some hidden coverages and stuff like that. Dude, I don't know how this game gets to 42 points. It'll probably be a shootout now that I said that, but I think under 41.5 is the best play in this game.
Yeah, and, you know, I played first half under in the Texas A&M Miami game, and that was, what, scoreless at halftime, I believe? So,
yeah. If only they could all be that easy.
Yeah, I know. I wish they were all that easy. I probably will do the same here. Both these teams also very slow. You know, I was looking at Brett Ciancia, who you'll hear from here in just a moment. His numbers, I think Ohio State amongst the P4 is the slowest team in the country. 68 out of 68, I think Miami 64th. So I could see a first half under as well, 20.5. There is a juice 21.5 out there at FanDuel if you want to pay the price there. But I think it's a low scoring game. I think Miami, if their defense can hang around, I think there's a chance, especially if it gets to 10. 10 for me is the play, and we'll see if we get back to 10. Let's get to the three games on New Year's Day. Man, I'm so fired up for Oregon-Texas Tech. Noon kick, our colleague Stormy Bonatoni, she'll be on the sidelines for this one. She's got, by the way, shout out to Stormy. What a nice run here. She had the Oregon-James Madison game. She'll have the Orange Bowl, Texas Tech-Oregon. And then she has the FCS National Championship, a little Monday night football between Illinois State, the Cinderella story of the FCS and the power that is the Montana State Bobcats. But this game has Oregon as a 2.5-point favorite. Circa right now is a juice 2.5. I doubt we get to 3, but we'll see. It seems to be the way this one is trending right now. Oregon, really, as we discussed, you know, last week, took their foot off the gas as the back door got home for James Madison. And then you've got Texas Tech. And how much, Adam, when you look at these two teams, do you weigh the strength of schedule? Because that's something, and you mentioned Brad Powers, who we referenced a lot, you know, when he talks about some of his handicapping angles, strength of schedule plays in. Texas Tech, 68th strength of schedule, according to Jeff Sagarin, Oregon 14th. How much does that play into this game for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to be a factor, right? I think it has to be something that you consider. And by the way, with Stormy, she'll also be the in-stadium host for the FBS National Championship game, the College Football Playoff National Championship game on, what is that, January 19th, I believe. So, yeah, quite a run for Stormy, to say the least. Yeah, the strength of schedule thing has to matter. I mean, it just simply has to, right? That being said, we've had this conversation on this show a lot. This season, I think we even talked about it last season too. Dan Lanning is James Franklin to me. Until I'm proven otherwise, Dan Lanning is James Franklin in that when he could be the bully, he's going to be damn good at it. When he can't be the bully, he's going to struggle. And when you look at his 47-7 record at Oregon here, pummeled by Georgia in the first game, of course, that was his previous employer. Not really a big surprise. I guess we could kind of draw a line through that. But he lost to Washington three times in the first 2 years, lost the Civil War game to Oregon State in his first season, then, of course, losing to Ohio State badly in the quarterfinal last year. 41-21 does not describe how that game was played. And then lost to Indiana this season, too. And, of course, again, as you mentioned, it was very, very sloppy and, you know, a good win for Oregon in terms of context, but they had a hell of a time with Iowa this season, too. Lanning's just not good in this type of role, in my opinion. And he's not very good in close games either, where those losses, Washington, all three of those losses by a field goal, lost to Oregon State by four. The Indiana game was by 10. When he's got to play a close game, I don't know that he's a great game management guy. I don't know that he puts his players in position to succeed. Both of his coordinators are heavily distracted right now with Will Stein going to Kentucky, Tosh Lupoy going to Cal. I took Texas Tech outright in this game. I have them favored in my power ratings to begin with. I realize the schedule's a concern. I realize Baron Morton staying healthy for a game, let alone a season, is a very, you know, difficult thing to get. But I think this Texas Tech defense is awesome. I really, truly believe they can slow Oregon down here in this game. And what Texas Tech has done this season with two first-year coordinators in Mack Leftwich and Sheil Wood, alongside a recruiting killer in Joey McGuire, it's very impressive what Texas Tech has done in very short order to build this program up. Whereas Oregon's had games like this, they've had chances like this, they've had cracks like this, and under Lanning, they've fallen short in most of them. So I'll take Texas Tech here. I don't think there's a huge athleticism difference, and I just don't trust Lanning in a game where he's playing a team on his level.
The best cover team in college football, the Texas Tech Red Raiders, 12-1 ATS, third best cover margin in college football, too, covering by 10.4 points per game. The team that covered by the most points this year, the Indiana Hoosiers, covering by 11 points per game. Talk about a bully. That is Kurt Cignetti, and I mean that in a positive way. And Indiana being a touchdown favorite in the Rose Bowl against Alabama is just, it's mind-blowing to think. But it's the right number. I'm not saying the number's wrong. It's just, as a college football fan, to think that on New Year's Day, Indiana in the Rose Bowl for the first time since 1967 is a touchdown favorite against the bluest of blue bloods in Alabama. I have not bet this game yet. I've kind of waffled back and forth. I bet on Alabama in the first round. It looked like it was a dead wrong side, and then they figured things out, and Oklahoma couldn't really get it going. They did get outgained. Alabama did. They had less than 300 yards of offense in that game. I don't know what to do with this game. Right now, you could lay 6.5 if you like Indiana. You could take 7 if you want Bama. What do you make of this one in the Rose Bowl on New Year's Day?
Yeah, I make this number 6.5, so I'm right in line with the market on this one. I mean, I guess there's a couple of ways to look at this, right? I mean, you know, first of all, and I thought this was a really salient point that I saw somebody make on Twitter, and I wish I could give them credit for it. I probably should have bookmarked it, but I just kind of looked at it and thought, oh, well, that's interesting, and then kind of, you know, went about my day. But when you look at Fernando Mendoza here and the better teams that he played, right, outside of Illinois, where he had a 5-0 touchdown interception ratio and that complete shellacking back in September. Against Iowa, 13 of 23, 2 touchdowns and a pick. Against Oregon, 20 of 31, a touchdown and a pick. Against Penn State, 19 of 30, a touchdown and a pick. Against Ohio State, 15 of 23, touchdown and a pick. Like, this was a guy who really padded numbers against the bad teams that they played, right? Had a 9-0 touchdown interception ratio against Kennesaw State and Indiana State. 4-0 touchdown interception ratio against Michigan State in a game that was a tough spot for them coming off of the Oregon win, but Michigan State was just a tumultuous program all season long. 4-0 against Wisconsin, a team that late in the year, you know, they were wondering if Luke Fickell was going to get fired. Like, now you're playing Alabama, right? So Mendoza's going to have to prove it to me against a really, really good team. That's something I would certainly like to see here in this one. At the same time, I still have no idea if Ty Simpson is healthy. I know that Alabama did a complete 180 in the second quarter of that game against Oklahoma, but I don't know if he's healthy. I don't know, man. The Kalen DeBoer angle is kind of funny, you know, that he's coaching against Indiana here, but I think this number is good. I think maybe I could make an argument for the under, but I'm not going to play this game. There's nothing that really interests me from a betting standpoint about this game. There are a lot of things about the game itself that interest me, just probably nothing from a betting standpoint.
Yeah, Kirk Cignetti also, too, was on the Alabama staff. He left to go to Indiana University of Pennsylvania, the D2 program. Stephen Daly out. The unfortunate situation, got hurt celebrating post-game, getting high fives from fans. Omar Cooper, though, according to Thamel, should be good to go. So that's a big return there for Indiana as he got hurt in that Big Ten championship game. Yeah, I have not bet this game on the side. We'll dive into this a little bit more with Humans on the Tuesday podcast. The game that I did bet right from the jump in the quarterfinals is I laid it with Georgia. I laid 6.5. I really wanted Mississippi to win big in the first round to maybe get a little bit of a suppressed number. And if Ole Miss comes out and they're firing like they were against Tulane, you know, I'll tip my cap, but you've got extra time for Georgia to prepare. That all being said, Georgia was in a similar spot last year against Notre Dame in the Sugar Bowl, and they did not show all that well, but I think Georgia, anything under a touchdown for me is worth a look here. I think this is a spot where you've got Kirby Smart after losing last year in the Sugar Bowl. You've got Ole Miss and their staff, Pete Golding. How does he turn things around after winning that game? And then also, you've got the coaches that are going to LSU kind of playing that double duty, right? They got that win at home. How do they turn back around and refocus on Kirby Smart? Because it did feel like, Adam, down the stretch, Georgia was playing by far their best football. The second half against Texas, I know the Georgia Tech game was not impressive whatsoever, but I kind of throw that one out. And then they were they were absolutely dominant in the SEC championship game. So I like Georgia, anything under a touchdown here against Ole Miss.
Yeah, I think everything that you said is fair. I mean, you know, was this... What do things look like now for Ole Miss, right? I mean, everyone hated Lane Kiffin. They were kind of unified with that. Also, we had already seen them pummel Tulane once, so it really wasn't that big of a surprise to see them pummel Tulane again. What do they do now with the Georgia team that racked up 510 yards against them during the regular season, 221 on the ground, 34 first downs, had the ball for 38 minutes? Like, Georgia had three long back-breaking drives in the second half of that game that carried over into the fourth quarter, where they scored, you know, pretty much all their points and you know, wound up winning that game 43-35. I shouldn't say all their points. They had 17 unanswered, you know, at the end of that game.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's Pete Golding's defense getting torched by Georgia in the first game. And now Pete Golding, the head coach of this football team, where the defense was the weaker of the two units here this season for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's something that, I'm kind of curious to get your thoughts on this here without going too long, without getting too philosophical, but like this Georgia team, I feel like we've not talked about them at all this season. I feel like they've not been discussed on the national landscape really at all whatsoever. I mean, they don't have any offensive standouts, right? Stockton's played well. Frazier's run the football well. They have one wide receiver in Branch who does everything for them, it feels like. Like, no one's talked about this Georgia team all season long. They won the SEC. No one's really talked about it. It was more, Ty Simpson was hurt, and Alabama this, and Alabama that. And then this line comes out, and I'm like, well, the odds makers get it. Because I kind of expected this line to be a little bit shorter than it is, kind of like you thought, maybe in the 5.5-6 range. But 6.5-7, like, seems pretty dialed in, I think. So, I don't know, man. I just feel like we haven't talked about Georgia a whole lot, and this is the type of game they just go out there and win, like, 34-14, 34-17, something like that. I will mention one stat that I found fascinating. Ole Miss on the season, of course, they have played in, I guess they haven't played an extra game because Georgia played in the SEC title game. Same number of games for both these teams, right? Mm-hmm. Ole Miss, 72 trips into the red zone, 45 touchdowns. Georgia, 53 trips into the red zone, 42 touchdowns. So 19 fewer trips into the red zone for Georgia. Only three fewer touchdowns. They are very, very efficient when they get down there. I think that's the difference. I think it's ultimately why they cover.
I think thinking back to the SEC championship game and just the sheer dominance, and yes, was Alabama a little bit banged up? It's, yeah, that's true. But they held that Alabama team to under 100 yards for, what, 44 minutes and 45 seconds. You know, they had a late... I think they had a play on the end of the third quarter that got them over triple digits. I mean, that was sheer dominance. Now, the offense wasn't great against Alabama, but know, this is an Ole Miss defense that is not phenomenal. They are more known offensively. And I just, I knowing Kirby Smart and the maniac that he is, and thinking last year in this Sugar Bowl to lose this game, Brett Ciancia put out in his, you know, pick six plus since 2019, when Georgia has 10 plus days to prepare, Kirby Smart's 28-3. And it feels like the defense is getting better throughout the season. Gunnar Stockton playing really well. By the way, both these guys did finish top 10 in Heisman, Trinidad Chambliss for Ole Miss and Gunnar Stockton for Georgia. But I think that goes to your point. Like, if you ask let's say a college football fan, not a crazy college football, but still a strong college football fan, you know, who had the better year, Gunnar Stockton or Trinidad Chambliss? I think most would say Trinidad Chambliss. Gunnar Stockton finished higher in the Heisman. I don't think most people realize that Gunnar Stockton was seventh in the Heisman Trophy voting this year. And I know it wasn't a stellar year for the Heisman Trophy candidates, but still, I think to your point, it's very fair. I fully anticipate Georgia to win this game, and Georgia, Ohio State, more than likely in that semifinal, giddy up. That is going to be an absolute war.
Yeah, I mean, does that total even get to 40? And that, I mean, Miami and Ohio State is 41.5. Like, I would probably take Georgia's defense over Miami's. They're at least pretty much on the same level, so it'll probably be a very similar total there. But part of me wonders, and it's much harder for Georgia to do this than it was for Ohio State to do this because of the strength of schedule, but didn't it kind of feel to you like throughout the course of the season, Georgia just expected to be in the playoff? So they just made sure they didn't kill anybody during the regular season, right? You know, like, they didn't ride anybody too hard. Like, Frazier led the team in carries, but Chauncey Bowers was right there too. Stockton obviously ran around a good amount. Like I said, Branch did everything, 73 catches. I think nobody else had more than like 27 or 29, something like that. But like, there's like a million guys that had a catch for Georgia this season. Like, it just sort of feels like they just kind of expected to be in this position where they probably have to be fresher than Ole Miss, I would say. Not just because they've had the longer layoff, but just because, like, it seems like they just utilize their depth all season long, whereas other teams don't necessarily have that luxury.
The two games that felt like they turned it up, end of the Texas game, the Alabama game. And look, you know, the Florida game, 24-20, had the Gunnar Stockton kneel at the one-yard line. And that was the great spot for Florida to bet on Florida. They were on, you know, the Sun Belt Billy firing bump rivalry game, all of that. But
probably should have lost to Tennessee.
Yeah, probably should have lost to Tennessee. The Auburn game, if that turnover at the goal line doesn't go their way. There were some calls that certainly went their way in that game as well. But I think down the stretch, they've been playing exceptional football. So I like Georgia in this spot. This was the spot I wanted to see. And if Ole Miss comes out and they're buttoned up and they make this a good game, hey, we'll enjoy it on New Year's Day on a fast track down there in New Orleans. But for me, I wanted to see what Golding and his staff did game two. After you had all the energy, you're at home, you know, bleep Lane Kiffin, all of that. By the way, did you see Lane Kiffin during the Houston Bowl? He's like wearing I don't know what the hell jacket. It was like a suede jacket. Looks like he just came out of the tanning booth.
He probably did. I can't believe I let that guy pull one over on me, thinking that there was a chance he'd actually stay at Ole Miss. What a horrible take.
Well, looking forward to these games. Once again, check out VSiN.com for all of the previews, all of our picks as well. We will be back next week to get you ready for the semifinals. Those will be Thursday and Friday. Recap, of course, what unfolded here in the quarterfinals. Let's take a quick break. We will say goodbye to Adam. We will welcome on Brett Ciancia. So, adios to Adam Burke. Thank you, sir, as always. We will see you in the new year. And when we come back here, it'll be Brett Ciancia of Pick Six Previews. And we keep it rolling. A familiar face to the podcast. He joined us every Wednesday throughout the regular season. And it's great to have him on before the college football playoff quarterfinals. It is our guy, Brett Ciancia. Pick Six Previews, Pick Six Plus, the weekly stat packet that we've been utilizing all year long. Brett, Merry Christmas. And I guess before we dive into the games that start on New Year's Eve and then New Year's Day, looking back at the first round games, how did your game graders jump out for those four winning teams?
Yeah, Merry Christmas to you, Tim, all the listeners. A happy 2026 coming up here. We got a great slate of games to preview. Yeah, looking back to the first round, actually went 2-0 in the picks. So a good successful week there. I called for both underdogs to win outright in the Power 4 versus Power 4 games. Of course, that's the Miami versus A&M and the Bama-Oklahoma. First with Miami, we talked about it. We said that the lines of scrimmage were going to determine this game, and Miami had it on both sides. You look at what they did defensively, getting to A&M seven times, seven sacks, nine tackles for loss. Reuben Bain really took over that game, three sacks himself. He blocked a field goal. And then on the offensive line, too, because remember, A&M had a great defensive front seven. Miami, really, they couldn't get the passing going, so they just went full run game. Mark Fletcher, 172 yards. They really established the run. That was the difference. It was the Mark Fletcher game, and they got it done. So Miami with the W there. And then over in the SEC, the rematch game, we talked several weeks about this one, how misleading that Oklahoma-Alabama first matchup was, how Alabama had outgained them by 200 yards in the first time. Blew it with a couple ridiculous plays there. Kind of the opposite happened here. Oklahoma had a 17-0 lead. Alabama really on life support. They had three key plays that changed that game. First, Oklahoma dropped a wide-open pass. Would have made it 24-7 at the time. That hurt. Then they dropped a punt, too. The punt snapped. The punter just fumbled the ball, gave Alabama a short field for a score, and then a 50-yard pick six to flip the game for Alabama. So they got it done. Again, we called for it, so 2-0 against the spread, 2-0 straight up, and really excited to break down these next four games.
You're looking at Miami-Texas A&M, just a game where it was pretty clunky offensively, but the defenses shined. Miami's defense, and we'll dive into this game first because it will be the first game up of the quarterfinals, but Miami's defense on the road at College Station, how did their numbers grade out for you?
Oh, they really excelled on defense. That was a difference in the game. They held A&M 33 points below their season average. It's hard to believe. Held them to just a field goal. And we saw all season long how dynamic Marcel Reed had been. They had the playmakers at receiver with Craver, Concepcion. All of them shut down, all of them nullified. Reed, they picked him off twice, once in the end zone to seal the game in the final play. You credit Miami. And they held them 50 points below their normal quarterback rating, too. I know that's getting a little bit into the numbers here, but I have that there in Pick 6 Plus. You like to compare QB rating versus the season average versus the individual game. They held them way below average. So something to keep an eye on here as Miami goes up against another elite passing attack, Ohio State. But it was all defense, great game grade from the formula for me for Miami. Corey Heatherman, coordinator of the week, obviously earned it there for Miami. So, strong defensive performance.
Lastly, on the games from prior to Christmas, and we'll dive into the previews here in just a moment, Oregon versus James Madison. I'm curious how your numbers graded out Oregon, because defensively, it certainly felt like they took their foot off the gas late in that game. We discussed the bad beat situation if you laid the points like I did with Oregon against JMU. So when you went into your grading of Oregon against James Madison, Brett, how did that ultimately come out? Because defensively, it did feel like in that third quarter and fourth quarter, they just kind of let James Madison do whatever they wanted.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really a tale of two sides of the ball here. Offensively, off the charts. I like to do this opponent-adjusted stats, comparing what James Madison's defense allowed all season versus what they allowed against Oregon in the single game. And Oregon, one of the best performances of the season. They went 5.3 yards above the average that JMU was allowing. That's off the charts. That's why you see Oregon up at the top five of all my offensive numbers right now. So offense-wise, incredible. They averaged 10 yards a play, a first down every snap. So they were perfect on offense. Defensively had some cracks there. They also gave up 500 yards. So you're at a net zero in the yardage game, which is hard to believe, winning by 17. But defense, it's almost like they let their foot off the gas there in the second half. And some of that may have been some backups in there rotating in, but still you need to finish that off. And I know that Dan Lanning was furious after the game. He holds them to high standards and you're going to see them come out motivated here in the second round. So excellent offense, kind of a D or an F on defense.
All right, let's get into it. We've got four quarterfinal games. This is what we've been looking forward to when this bracket came out. The first round. I thought the Friday night game, atmosphere wise, the comeback certainly was strong. And then, you know, what we saw down there in College Station. But these were the four matchups I think most of us were hoping for one way or another. So let's go to the Cotton Bowl on New Year's Eve. Right now, as we record this, Ohio State is a 9.5-point favorite. On Sunday night, the 28th, there were a couple 10s that showed, and I did grab a little nibble of Miami plus the 10 on Sunday night. I do think there's a possibility of that returning. Low total, lowest of the four games, no doubt, at 41.5, Brett. So diving into the numbers of Miami versus Ohio State, and someone who loves history, I'm sure this brings back some memories of that national championship game where Ohio State gets the win in multiple overtimes. What do you make of this spot here? Ohio State 9.5-point favorite with a total around 41.5.
You're right, Tim. Very nostalgic seeing these two helmet logos going up against each other. You know, that was some of the first years that I was really into college football as a youngster. And that game, I think it still is one of the best of all time. It was so hard hitting. Every inch was a battle. The star power, you had the underdog factor taking down the defending champs. Craig Krenzel, his moment there as a Buckeye national champion quarterback. So, yeah, I can't wait to see these two match up. I'd love to see Miami come out in some of those retro 2000s uniforms, too. That'd be pretty cool. Anyways, though, with this one, again, lines of scrimmage. I talked to Miami last week with A&M. That was going to be the key. And you have a couple strong offensive lines and defensive lines here. Looking at Ohio State, though, I think they're going to come out here motivated. And it reminds me of when they lost to Michigan last November. Same score, 13-10. Same score they just lost to Indiana. And they came back in the playoff bracket really renewed, you know, more aggressive with downfield passing. I think you're going to see some of that, too, because Brian Hartline is now out and going to USF, their offensive coordinator. Ryan Day taking back the play calling. I think you're going to see some more downfield shots. And that's what really elevated Ohio State last year once the playoff kicked off. They just went all out vertical shots and it worked. So, yeah, I like Ohio State here. You know, my numbers say 9.6 and 9.6 favor for Ohio State. So that's less than a point. So maybe the better bet here is actually going under. I really like the under in this one. And I see that that's moved down in our direction, but two elite defenses, you know, Miami coming in top five on most defensive metrics. Ohio State could be the number one overall on defense, the only defense with four consensus All-Americans. So, yeah, I think low scoring, but I'm going to have to trust Ohio State here a bit more, and I think they get the win, and I'll go under here.
Something you added to your pick six plus this year was pace, and these are two teams, Brett, that are very, very slow.
Slow versus slow, both in the bottom 10 of pace of play in terms of how quickly they're snapping the ball. So, yeah, you've seen Ohio State do it all season, too. I think they were actually the slowest pace in America. They slowed the game down. They let their defense get it done. When you're looking from Miami's perspective, because they really handled Marcel Reed pretty well, and he's more mobile than what you're going to find from Julian Sand. But I think with Sand, you have much more pinpoint accuracy. So I think Reed left some yards on the field for them in the pass game. Sand's going to hit him. He's on pace for an NCAA record in terms of completion percentage. They're going to get the ball to Smith, Tate, Max Clair over the middle. So, you know, I trust Ohio State just a shred more. I'm going to go with them to cover and then to go under, more importantly.
Yeah, you felt the big return of Keontae Scott for sure from Miami in that Texas A&M game. So can't wait for this one to ring in the new year. Really excited for this matchup. You know, like you said, nostalgia for us college football fans. Brett even points out, you know, in his matchup, the last time these teams have faced each other. So always love that in the pick six plus. Let's get to New Year's Day. And when the bracket broke couple weeks back and you looked at the possible quarterfinal games, it was pretty clear that the game that would have the shortest point spread would be Oregon and Texas Tech. And this is a Texas Tech team that you have followed even closer than the rest of the P4. You went down to Lubbock, you witnessed that Texas Tech BYU game in person, and you've been really bullish on Texas Tech all season long. So I actually want to take a step back here, Brett, and go to the preseason and where you were on this Texas Tech team. Because, look, there were a lot of people who believed in Texas Tech. I'll be honest, I was a bit skeptical how this would all come together with, you know, the NIL money. You've seen kind of things not all hit perfectly, and they were phenomenal this year. Best team against the spread. Lone loss was when they didn't have their starting quarterback against Arizona State. So looking back to the preseason, where were you on this Texas Tech team before we head into this matchup on New Year's Day?
Yeah, well, I'll take you all the way back to March and April, and that's when the bulk of my research for the Preview magazine, that's where I'm calling head coaches, coordinators, and I like to put some feelers out there. I ask, coaches about opponents within their conference, who's looking strong, in their opponent scouting, all that kind of stuff. And every single Big 12 coach I talked to, they were blown away by Texas Tech's talent that they accumulated this cycle. Now, the common theme was definitely the most talented team. Will it all be able to click? Will they get all those new players together and have it click by the time August comes around? I predicted yes. And in the Preview magazine there, I had them predicted second in the Big 12, playing for the Big 12 title game, the only magazine to do so. A lot of people faded. Texas Tech put them third, fourth, fifth. I think the most common matchup was K-State, Iowa State for the Big 12 title game. I had them sixth and seventh in the conference. So Texas Tech has proved me right. Yeah, you're right. I've stayed ahead of the curve with them too. I mean, every single week in Pick 6 Plus, every single one, I went back and checked. I had them as my lean, my prediction to cover the spread, and they proved us right here. 12-1 against the spread this season. All 12 wins by 20-plus points. Just phenomenal performance, both sides of the ball. But really, it's their defense that stands out. You're talking about one of the only defenses with multiple consensus All-Americans. You got Jacob Rodriguez, the do-it-all linebacker. Very disruptive. 7 forced fumbles, on pace for a record. 4 picks. Took a couple back for touchdowns. Ran one in on offense even. David Bailey, the nation's sack leader. But you're right about this matchup. When this came out, I was already excited about it. It's strength versus strength. You have one of the best offenses with Oregon against an elite defense with Texas Tech. And I'll dig in a little bit here on this preview. I'll show you what I went to. I wanted to, look at their 4 hardest opponents that they played. Oregon, of course, they're off the charts on offense statistically. How'd they perform against their 4 strongest defenses? And that, of course, for them was Indiana, Iowa, Washington, Wisconsin. In those 4 tough defense spots, they were held significantly under their averages, averaging 20 points a game, 300 yards a game, 4.4 yards per play, well below the season average. I did the same for Texas Tech's defense, looking at how they performed against their 4 strongest offenses. And they were better against the top 4 offenses they played. They held them to just 10 points a game, 250 yards per game. And that's, of course, BYU twice, Utah, and then Kansas. So, when push comes to shove, when it's strength versus strength, I'm actually going to side Texas Tech here. They're number 2 in game grader, number 1 by far, looking at the recent game grader, the last 4 games. So I'm going to go Texas Tech here. I think the wrong team's favored. 12-1 against the spread. Let's make it 13-1. I'm going to go Texas Tech to win.
Yeah, this is no doubt the most, I would say, intriguing game, obviously from a point spread standpoint, being the only one under a field goal. What do you expect from a pace here? You mentioned what you can get from Oregon offensively. This is not the highest total of the 4 games. That would be Georgia and Ole Miss, but 51.5, this game down at Hard Rock Stadium, so outdoors there in Miami Gardens. What do you make of this total, and how do you see this thing playing out, stylistically from a points standpoint?
Yeah, well, looking at pace of play, Texas Tech is a fast team in terms of pace. They're in the top 10, quickest, snaps per time per snap. Oregon down at 50th. So it's kind of counterintuitive. You think of Oregon as the fast pace, up tempo. That's not really the case, but they do get yards in chunks. So they score quickly. It's just that they don't go at a quick pace. So in terms of the total, in terms of the final score, I went Texas Tech 26, Oregon 23. That would call for 49 combined points. So we'll see where that shakes out with the final over-under spread there. But I like Texas Tech to win it outright. And it's a little bit of faith in the offense with Baron Morton that they could improve a little bit. If you're looking at this statistically, that's the weakest link of this game is Texas Tech's offense. But when they've needed to, they've been able to rally up the points. I am worried about their red zone offense. We talked about this when they played BYU both times against BYU. They move it just fine, but inside the 15, inside the 20, they freeze up and they're held to field goals. So red zone touchdown conversion is key here. And then their defense, I think, is going to win the defense versus offense there, Texas Tech's defense.
You look at strength of schedule, Sagarin has Texas Tech at 68th, while Oregon 14th. Does that come into play? But can't wait for this game. Haven't bet this game personally yet, so we'll see how this one plays out. Brett on the Red Raiders as the slight underdog. Let's go to the Rose Bowl. Of course, our guy Wes Reynolds will be in attendance. He's the happiest man in all of Las Vegas. Been wearing Indiana garb, I want to say, pretty much all year long. His team is undefeated, Heisman Trophy winner, everything has come up Indiana, and it's unbelievable when you think about it, Brett. You know, as you talk about, you know, we're a college football betting podcast. Everyone, you know, thinks about the history of this sport, and you've got Indiana as a 6.5 or 7 point favorite against Alabama in the Rose Bowl. Just words that you couldn't imagine saying in 2 years ago. And here we are, Indiana undefeated, a touchdown favorite at Circa, 6.5 at other spots. Before we dive into this game, circling back a little bit to the Oklahoma game, down 17-0. It looked like Alabama was, you know, toast. And I jokingly stated, you know, regarding the committee a couple weeks ago when they recognized Alabama's gutsy fourth down conversion against Auburn. Well, they had a gutsy fourth down conversion against Oklahoma, and it kind of turned things around. They get that pick six, and everything goes up for Alabama there. How did you grade out this Alabama team's performance on the road at Norman there to start the playoffs?
Yeah, they graded out okay. You know, it's you can't sell it short because it was a playoff win, it was a road win, it was a rematch win. But looking at the stats here, they were held to just 260 yards, yeah, outgained by 100 yards by one of the worst offenses in the SEC, Oklahoma. So that's a concern. They gave up almost 400 yards to John Mateer, who you know, he was second worst in the SEC in QB rating in SEC play. So that's concerning. They were net even on yards per play, 4.8 apiece. So, yeah, I mean, but hey, you got to make the key plays. They didn't make them the first matchup. They made them this time. We talked about the 50-yard pick six, Xavier Brown off of John Mateer. And then you got to have some stars step up, too. And I thought that the freshman receiver, Brooks, really stepped up. Two touchdown grabs. I think it was his first two this whole season. And somebody had to do it because Ryan Williams was dropping balls. I'm waiting for him to reemerge. I mean, he had the huge 2024, has been very hot and cold this year. I want to see him come back. But Brooks stepped up, two touchdowns. And yeah, after halftime, they really laid it on. So great coaching job by DeBoer to adjust and then keep them focused down 17-0. That could have been a spot where a team quit and they fought back even harder. So hats off to Alabama. They're going to need a little bit more juice here against Indiana.
Yeah, there's no doubt. So let's dive into this matchup. Indiana, number one team in the country. Breaking down the numbers for Indiana, let's look at them offensively. You know, what stands out about this Indiana team from you, you know, based off of the metrics?
Yeah, well, what stands out right away is the pass game. It goes without saying. You have a Heisman winner, but just a big arsenal of receivers to throw to. Elijah Surratt, the receiver. Charlie Becker was very involved in the Big Ten title game, had that game-sealing catch. But yeah, if you look at my advanced stats here for passing offense, number one in the country, Indiana. So that is a far cry from what Alabama just struggled with Oklahoma, who was, I think, 55th or something out of the 68 Power Four. They were way below average. So you're going from that up to number one passing offense. And it's balanced, too. It's not just the pass game. You have a top 15 rushing attack per my numbers. And then overall, when you combine that, that's a top five offense, yards per play, opponent adjusted. So yeah, love Indiana's offense. And it's double-sided, too. They have the defense to go with it. So I don't see any statistical flaw on this Indiana stat sheet here. They're top 20, top 15 in almost every number you could look at. And my game grader actually predicts, you know, it's funny to think of Indiana as a touchdown favorite over Alabama. I started pick six previews in 2012, and that was right at the peak of the Saban dynasty. And Indiana was you pencil them in every year at the bottom of the conference back then. So to see this on paper is just shocking, but that's just where we are. And I think it should be higher. I think this, my numbers have it around 9.5, 10 points for Indiana. So I think there's some value there at 6.5 or 7 where it is right now with Indiana.
You got some good news from Pete Thamel on Monday, the 29th. Omar Cooper has been dealing with a little bit of a lower body injury, expected to be full go for the Rose Bowl. But unfortunately, Stephen Daly, as we recall, the unfortunate situation as he was celebrating with fans came up injury. He will be out for the Hoosiers. All right, last game, the Sugar Bowl, and this one might surprise some people, so I'm curious to get your opinion on this one. We've got Georgia, Ole Miss, a rematch of a game that we got earlier in the year. Fireworks in that game, 43-35. Take us back to that game real quickly. How did you grade out those two teams in that 43-35 Georgia come from behind win over Ole Miss?
Yeah, that first matchup, it was like the old Big 12 back in the day. It was up and down the field scoring. Neither team could stop each other. Ole Miss had, I think, a 9-point lead heading into the fourth quarter. Could not be stopped. Now, turns out they couldn't stop Georgia either. And Georgia had the best fourth quarter of the two. Gunnar Stockton performed like he had all season in the fourth quarter and the second half. It's one of those things we keep saying, that Gunnar Stockton's so clutch. And I went back and tried to find some numbers on it, and it held up. It's true. If you look at post-halftime stats, second half, third quarter, fourth quarter, he's number two in power four in terms of quarterback rating after halftime. So very efficient. That's not even factoring in his legs, which are very effective after halftime. So anyways, they pulled away in the fourth quarter. It was all Georgia in the fourth. They got the W. If you look at yardage, Georgia outgained them by 100 plus yards. So, you know, a solid victory for Georgia there. But I think you're going to have another shootout this time around. Look for points, 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 and a ton of yards. So I see a shootout again. But I think that 7 points is too much. I think if you're looking at a shootout type game, I think there's some value there with Ole Miss with 7 points. My numbers have it Georgia by two, you know, calling for more of a field goal type game. So I'll take Ole Miss with the 7 points. And I know, Tim, how dangerous that is to go against Georgia with Kirby Smart. He's 28-3 when he has 10 plus days of preparation. So that's scary. And I'll tell you one quote that really scared me during the Texas Bowl. They had Lane Kiffin on in the second quarter interviewing about his LSU job, his transition from Ole Miss. He was saying how the Ole Miss staff, they do their team meetings for Ole Miss, then they hop on the other line and do their calls with LSU. That's a little concerning because they should be 100% focused on Georgia. So that was after I published this prediction. A little worried, though. But so I'm going to go Ole Miss here, still to cover, but a couple asterisks there to worry about.
All right, you and I going head-to-head. I don't like to go head-to-head with you, Brett, all that often, but I did lay 6.5 here with Georgia. That was my first bet. I just, you know, I a couple things more anecdotal. You know, last time we saw Georgia in the Sugar Bowl was against Notre Dame. They lost that game. You know, you mentioned I'm fascinated to see how this Ole Miss staff, everything kind of was locked in for that Tulane game. You know, I laid the first half number. They were dominant, and now we'll see how they bounce back and prepare for this one. Now, it is worth noting, if you want to play, you know, the other side of everything, Kirby Smart, that number you pointed out is pretty wild. The last time they had this much time to prepare, they lost that game, right? Now, it was Gunnar Stockton making his first career start with Carson Beck getting injured, but they did lose that game to Notre Dame back last January. So, yeah, we'll see how it all plays out. But I'm looking forward to these games, man. Just a reminder to folks, Brett, are you going to be continuing to do Pick 6 Plus throughout the rest of the playoffs?
Yeah, absolutely. We still have two more editions. We have the one coming out after this second round of games to preview the semifinals, the Final Four. And then another edition coming out to preview the national title. So hop on in there, Pick 6 Plus. We're going to open up for 2026 as well, a little early bird special. If you want to lock in for the 2026 season coming up, that'll include some spring editions too, looking at transfer portal, recruiting rankings, coaching carousel, you know, kind of behind the scenes as I develop my magazine in the spring and summer. So yeah, huge season this year. It's been a pleasure being on with you. Been great to meet so many of the listeners and connect on Twitter. It's been a good year, too. Let's keep it going in the playoff here against the spread. 2-0 first round. It looks like me and you are head-to-head on the Georgia game, but otherwise, let's get some W's and keep it rolling.
Brett, always appreciate it, man. Looking forward to picking your brain before the semifinals. And follow Brett on Twitter at Pick6Previews. Once again, Pick6 Plus, the informational packet. We've used it all year. It's been fantastic. Great asset to have. For Brett Ciancia and Adam Burke, thanks to Rick and Ryan, our producers today. I'm Tim Murray. We'll be back on Tuesday with another edition of the VSiN College Football Betting Podcast. We'll have Matt Eumanns on to preview all four of the quarterfinal games. This has been the VSiN College Football Betting Podcast.